Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. To paraphrase Charles Dickens, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times. It's the best of times because for the first time in many, many years, dare I say decades, it's no longer politics as usual. With the Trump administration in office, it looks like we don't have to be mired anymore in the status quo. Trump and his unorthodox team are at least trying to take a wrecking ball to a deeply entrenched, corrupt, and broken system kept barely alive by an establishment uniparty whose agenda is simply to keep the gravy train going for the politicians themselves, while America deteriorates economically, socially, culturally, and spiritually. Finally, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It's the worst of times because we're still in that tunnel. We still inhabit a culture that has undergone more than a half century, nearly a century, of deconstruction through the corrosive efforts of cultural Marxists who have been shockingly successful at subverting every institution, every social structure, every value that made America the greatest country and the greatest civilization in human history. That tunnel that we occupy is called postmodernism. And while postmodernism and cultural Marxism are not the same thing, there is some overlap in the broad sense that both have waged a largely successful war against the true, the good, and the beautiful. It's been a disturbingly steep and accelerated civilizational decline. If we're going to make America and Western civilization great again, we must strive to throw off this cultural subversion and reclaim the cultural values of the true, the good, and the beautiful, which are absolutely essential for the flourishing of civilization. What is postmodernism? How did we arrive in a period of cultural history called postmodernism? What do we do to escape it? Important questions, and here to address them is my upcoming guest here at The Right Take, who has written a book about this very theme called The Postmodern Predicament. So stay with us here at the intersection of politics and culture, because you don't want to miss this interview. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the other important conversations we are having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a Catholic author, speaker, and personal mentor. He taught theology and philosophy while serving as a high school minister for almost a decade. He speaks and ministers regularly, often together with his wife, Jackie, on podcasts and in the media. He has a brand new book out, which we're going to dive into today. Bobby Angel, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Mark.
I'm very glad to have you. Bobby, first tell us a little bit about your background and about the ministry of you and your wife.
Sure. So I am born and raised in Florida, and after college, really, it was as I was beginning my undergraduate studies, I came alive to my Catholic faith. I kind of went through the motions growing up, but really late high school into college was just wanting to know really why we believe what we believe, and really had an encounter to the point of, I think God is real. And if that is the case, then everything has to change. It's not just the ritual or going through the motions. So it was a real deep dive, and wrestling with God and trying to live the normal college life and feeling a tug towards the priesthood, and was running away from that for a while, and eventually relented, spent 3 years in seminary formation, open to the process of if that's what God wanted of me, but ultimately felt the call to marriage. Met my wife, and 11 years of marriage, 5 kids later, she too had a real conversion into her faith at around the same time on the other side of the country in California. And so we've always had a heart for youth ministry and working with young people. And we've been traveling and speaking and presenting on the Catholic faith and its different tenets for a number of years now, and stuff online. And was blessed to work at an all-boys Catholic high school for about 10 years and doing campus ministry and teaching. And it would, in the later years, I was actually teaching philosophy to the seniors, which was a great challenge of 17, 18-year-old boys who are checked out, and getting them to think critically at all, or even just to think. And even like why does philosophy matter was what I cut my teeth on, and really because of my seminary experience, which they taught us philosophy, was I at all capable or even daring to attempt that? So out of those experiences was the nuggets of what became this book, which is a primer, kind of like a 101 for a person that is busy, doesn't really care about philosophy. Just how did we get here? And then what do we do about it?
I can vouch for what you're saying about teaching teenage boys, because I have taught boys that age range in the homeschooling, the Catholic homeschooling community that I was part of until recently, until I moved from California to Texas. And, even among homeschooled kids who tend to be a little, have a bit of an edge over public school kids, it's difficult to get through to especially boys. Okay, let me get right to your book, The Postmodern Predicament, subtitled, and a Roadmap for Recovery and Restoration, because there's so much to dive into. As you alluded to, it's a sort of a whirlwind trip through a couple of millennia of philosophy, all the way from Plato to postmodernism. Although I do want to assure listeners, and I know my listeners are smart people, but I want to assure those who might think that the word philosophy means that this book is a heavy or pedantic read, I want to assure them that it is not. You break down practically the whole history of Western thought into really digestible bites in a very conversational tone. And so, as you said, it's just right for a busy person who doesn't want to get bogged down in something that's, overly intellectual and demanding. And it really explains where we are in a very concise way. You write that the idea for this book first began percolating in your head as you were musing about a word that trickled down out of academia into popular culture, and that word is deconstruction. Can you tell us about why that inspired the book?
I was seeing different nuggets of postmodern thinking trickle out into common usage, one of them being my truth versus my opinion. It's like, well, that's my truth. And it always made my eye twitch a bit, because words matter. But I couldn't really until I looked at it in the philosophical context, do you see this is where this came from. And part of, we live in this postmodern after modernity time period where so much of reality is an attempt to be fluid, is attempt to remake what is good, what is true, what is beautiful in my own image. And even male and female, as we've seen, are also subject to, well, a woman can be whatever I want it to be, or a man can be whatever I want it to be. And so this is where, in trying to teach my high school boys, ideas have consequences, whether you agree with the premises or not, just to sit back and say, where did these ideas come from? And I was seeing online in particular this kind of train of deconstruction gain more and more energy, particularly in the Protestant world, where there was real hurt, there were real instances of abuse, and a real sense of questioning, what is the faith background in which I grew up in? Is Christianity even true? And so there was a latching on to whatever could provide healing, and what was trendy and in the waters was this sense of, well, deconstructing. Well, I'm deconstructing my faith is what you started to hear. Or you have these hashtags, exvangelical. And then even in the, once I saw it too, in the Catholic space starting to come in, of we're going to question all church authority, we're going to question the beloved saints and the popes, and no one is exempt. And again, we can honor the fact that no human being is perfect outside of the Virgin Mary and Jesus Christ. Everyone has fallen short. But the angst and the anger with which to tear everything down, and the word deconstruction comes out of this French intellectual thought, which I cite the American Psychological Association's definition in the book, which says that deconstruction is a form of critical analysis of literary texts. So it starts out by analyzing a text, Moby Dick or A Tale of Two Cities, and what the author meant doesn't really matter. It's what I am interpreting it to be now is the postmodern stance. So I'm deconstructing the meaning into what I want, because the assumption is there is no firm reference for language. There is no adequate grounding for truth. It's just words. It's just kind of gibberish. And so the problem I saw within Christianity was, like, it is good to question. It is good to raise where you have been hurt and hold leadership accountable. But the whole idea of I'm deconstructing my Christian faith, it's like, well, the tool in the toolbox you're using says that there is no truth. So how can you approach the way, the truth, and the life with that stance? Well, then you end up with the radical subjectivism of, well, my Jesus says this. And I even, when my wife and I did a video on this, I was amazed by kind of the dual, the feedback of appreciation, like, hey, thank you for explaining this. But I was also kind of surprised by the amount of people who have made deconstruction an identity. Like, this is who I am. I am a deconstructing Christian. And was like, you know, it's just, you probably don't want to latch your meaning and purpose to that label, especially when caked into it is an assumption of there is no truth. Well, and then, of course, you got lots of comments like, well, my Jesus would never say this. My Jesus would be fine with the way I live. And it's like, well, then we're not really conforming to the gospel. We're making the gospel conform to us, which is a tale as old as time, in a way. And G.K. Chesterton, C.S. Lewis, Fulton Sheen all talked about this, the temptation to make the gospel conform to us rather than be changed by it.
Yeah, I don't want you to have to recapitulate your entire book here, but as I mentioned before, you begin with Plato and the classical era, and you move up through the Middle Ages. And I like that you gave the medievals their due in terms of preserving the intellectual legacy of the classical world and then adding layers and layers of their own philosophical and theological insights, because the common and wildly incorrect assumption is that the medieval era was a dark age and that the church suppressed knowledge. It was actually the church that shined a light into the darkness of that post-Roman era and that shaped the civilization that we call Christendom, or used to call Christendom. Tell us about the sacramental worldview of the medievals. What is it that they recognized about the world or saw in the world that we moderns have lost?
There was an enchantment with the world in the ancient and medieval time periods that, you know, Boston College professor Peter Kraft has talked about. The Enlightenment should really be called the Endarkenment, because it's this exaltation of human reason, but everything that's immaterial starts to just become diminished. You know, and so we've inherited, without realizing it, this very materialistic utilitarian lens. It's only real, it only matters if I can touch it or if it fits under a microscope. And so things like spirituality, religion, metaphysics, they're kind of nice if you want to believe in them, but it's like a flavor of ice cream. Like, it doesn't really matter. So the medieval, we could look back with, you know, part of it understanding too was like realizing if you take philosophy in an undergraduate course at a secular university, I realized the sequence usually goes Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, and the ancient philosophers, and then nothing important happened for 1500 years. Right. It's just this giant time warp until the Enlightenment, Descartes, the 1500s. And I was always like, that's interesting. And it's this pejorative Dark Ages word that gets thrown around, and the mean, nasty church kept people illiterate. But thank God science prevailed is the narrative we're given. And because of my seminary formation, I was really given the missing piece of, listen, this was a time as the Roman Empire falls apart and the European continent falls into disarray. It is Christianity that arises and that keeps the documents of the past alive. It is the minds of St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and Anselm who are synthesizing philosophy with theology. It is the Irish monks who are transcribing the works of Aristotle and others and keeping these texts alive and then going out from the Irish Isles to re-evangelize the continent and help people to read. And you also have this breathed into sense of the human person has dignity. Therefore, we are worth saving, like at the spiritual level, but also at the physical level. So you've got the rise of hospitals that start to be formed. We are worth educating. So the rise of universities in the medieval time period, it doesn't come out of nothing. It becomes out of the philosophy, under the philosophical understanding that the human person has a dignity, which is why the architecture also matters. That you have the beautiful Gothic cathedrals, and you have a real sense of there is a breathed into-ness in creation that we can look at with God's logic and rationality. This is why we can test. This is why we can run experiments, because the universe is understandable, and there's a logic that we can repeat experiments. So a lot of the early scientists were also monks or priests, because there was a sense of God is in his creation and he wants us to steward it. And so the art and architecture, which was also one of the fastest ways I would get my students' attention, it reflects that in the, we're going to invest in beauty. And it kind of goes upside down from the modern time period onward.
Well, after the Middle Ages, what changed in the 17th century with Descartes, who famously said, "I think, therefore I am"? What was his contribution to postmodernism?
So it's hard for us in the modern world with all of our conveniences and technologies to understand just how radical it was that so much was shifting in the 15th, 16th, 1700s. Like, the one church is split apart by Protestantism. You've got the printing press and so many other machines that are being developed. You've got an entire other continent that's been discovered. You've got North and South America. It's like, we had no idea those were there. So the world as we know it has expanded. And so there was a lot of just unrest and a lot of uncertainties. And so Rene Descartes, and through the book, I try to take a very pastoral approach. It comes out of my ministry background. I'm not here to vilify anyone in history. We can criticize ideas all day long, but to understand these people are products of their time period and are seeking some good, even if the fruits of it go awry. So Descartes is wanting to somehow, in amidst all this uncertainty, prove with certainty everything again. So his experiment is, I'm going to doubt everything. I'm going to doubt God exists. I'm going to doubt reality. I'm going to doubt myself. And then he comes to find, well, I can't doubt myself because I'm thinking. So at least I exist. So there, out of this, you get the, I think, therefore I am. Which seems like, okay, whatever. And it's not just that one philosopher thought something and everyone else decided, yeah, let's follow this guy. It's kind of like the relationship between art and culture, where art is somehow reflecting what's already going on in the culture and also informing it. So philosophers are not leading per se, but perhaps they are just putting their finger on the pulse of what's already happening, is the shift towards the self and then giving it a name in that way. I think, therefore I am, which turns upside down the ancient and medieval hierarchy of importance, where we're supposed to conform to what is objective, what is outside of me, what is true, the transcendentals, the commandments. That's where a happy life leads. And it's not overnight, but Descartes formulates what starts to become the subjective shift of, well, what matters is me. What I say is reality. What I say is beautiful. What I say is true. And again, it takes centuries, because people are still striving for discovery. The 1700s, 1800s are a time of great pioneering and experimenting, and obviously a lot of negative, a lot of violence, a lot of, there's always the light and the dark mixed together here. But there was a sense of, we're progressing towards utopia. Like, look at all these achievements, look at all these advancements, and we're sloughing off the embarrassing religious kind of spiritual stuff of the past. So the modern time period starts to become a bit of the teenage stage of humanity. Like, I don't need you, Dad, is the attitude that with all the bravado of, like, yeah, this can only go up.
So I guess the Enlightenment, and then all the way through the Industrial Revolution and into the 20th century, as you write in the book, gave us this false promise that our our capacity for unlimited progress would lead us to a utopian society. And then postmodernism, as you note, is this cynical, angry reaction against those broken promises. I think a lot of people would be hard-pressed to make the distinction between modernism or modernity and postmodernism. Can you make that distinction?
Sure. So we're kind of in postmodern time period right now, which itself is a rebellion against modernity. Like, it doesn't even have its own name. It's postmodern. So it is, in a way, you still got a number of people who are, let's say, moderns in the fixation on the utility, what is materially verifiable, like that is the most important thing. Or just the striving for like progress, like we got to get it right. Like we're almost there. We just got to try a little harder. The postmodern has just kind of embraced the meaninglessness of, whether they articulate it as such as not, life without God and without meaning. Because all these promises of progress gave way to the bloodiest century on earth, the 20th century. And there was such, especially after World War I, there was such a sense of defeat. Like, we thought we were beyond war. We thought we were beyond the tribalism and all this technology we wouldn't dare use it against each other. It's like, well, again, it's not about we just create the right economic society and there will be peace, or we just have the right leaders. That line of good and evil cuts through the human heart, as Solzhenitsyn said. So the postmoderns, unmoored from an objective faith or belief in God or some direction, meaning and purpose to my life, also have kind of given up striving for one. So it's like, well, just whatever. Like, eat, drink, and be merry. So you've either got the hedonistic response, or you've got the nihilistic response, which is, we're all going to die. Who cares? Life is meaningless. And so I would also show my students the art and architecture from the last 100 years and say, like, hey, so what happened? And they could just clearly say, well, this is hideous, like the some of the abstract art of the Jackson Pollock stuff that looks like a 5-year-old did it, and like compared against the Renaissance, the works of Michelangelo, Raphael, and then you've got the brutalist architecture of the Soviet Union and the drab buildings of America today, which are not designed to edify or beautify. They are designed to teach you are a cog in the machine. So even the architecture has changed, and even, sadly, church architecture. I've seen so many ugly churches in my life that you walk in, you're like, I don't know where to look. Or the stained glass is just kind of this abstract nonsense that I can't tell what's going on. So that when you do step into a church proper that is like orienting you towards beauty, you're just kind of like, oh, finally. Like, my soul can breathe. My soul feels like this is what this building is supposed to be. And the church is more than just a building, of course. Like, genuine worship can happen in any place. But there is something to the beauty. Like, the beauty matters, the building matters, the art matters, and it reflects what's going on in the waters of the culture. Do I feel like I'm directed to something, or is it just, life's meaningless, so you might as well enjoy the ride until it's over?
Yeah, about that ugly architecture. You mentioned the late philosopher Roger Scruton a few times in the book, and like you, I was really greatly impacted by his video about beauty when I first saw it, and listeners can find it easily on YouTube. It is an absolute must watch. How has, as you were suggesting a moment ago, perhaps the most destructive consequence of postmodernism is this full court assault on the true, the good, and the beautiful. How do we reject the moral and aesthetic relativism of postmodernism and reclaim those values, which are really vital to the flourishing of our civilization?
You know, the beautiful thing is that there's no one silver bullet, and really, you just kind of let it speak for itself. So, like, the ugliest building out there can't hold a candle to Notre Dame Cathedral. And like the life of a saint, a true saint, like a person who is just giving of themselves, who is radiating the love of Christ, shines as hidden as they may be, always shines brighter than the ugliest politician. Like, there is something to, you just let the truth out and it will defend itself. Like, no matter what governments decide by fiat, you can't undo what is objectively there. Like, whatever laws could be made against male and female, it doesn't matter because male and female will still be standing there. Like, the cells and the bones of our bodies, and now there's going to be, as you said, a full court assault. So there is a point of, I think most of us just want to be left alone. And we see what happens, though, when good people do nothing and the silent majority just stays silent. And there is a point of saying enough is enough. And especially when young people are drowning, this is the most anxious generation known to us. And here's the thing, too. It's like a lot of people point to the technology. That's a part of it. Technology definitely has a fragmenting effect on us, but it's again, it's a neutral tool. It's how we're using it. We can use it for the good. We can also just let it run our lives and allow it to make us miserable. And it's integration. It's bringing these things back together, what has been torn asunder, and it's bit by bit. And realizing we can't give what we don't have. So are we trying to live in such a way that is coherent? Are we surrounding ourselves with beauty? Are we checking our own behavior and attitude so that we can provide a lifeline to others and allow them to know, like, hey, your life has meaning. Like, your life has purpose. And there is something to shoot for.
You mentioned male and female a moment ago. One of the most disordered obsessions of our time and our culture is gender dysphoria. How has the postmodern predicament promoted gender dysphoria?
So again, this is stuff that 20 years ago would have just been like, huh? Like, what do you mean? But in academia, in some of this postmodern thinking, like this is going back to the 60s and 70s, like theorizing about pushing the envelope to a point where male and female are fluid. And it's, again, to the extent post-modernity is a reaction against modernity, there is a sense of, you know, we do get in trouble when we try to totally box in what does it mean to be a man, what does it mean to be a woman, and we create these caricatures of the masculine and the feminine. Like, the man has to dress this way and have this kind of job, the woman has to dress this way and have this job to be a woman. And we can honor the fact that, listen, there is a bit of a spectrum to the masculine gifts and the feminine gifts. But that doesn't mean there's a third sex. That doesn't mean there's endless options of our objective biology. And so here's where the technology and the postmodern belief of I make my own meaning, they come together. Because the technology has allowed for the facade of I could change my sex, which is again, just the artificial outward appearance of it, because every cell of my body is ordered to the masculine. Like, the bones of my body are ordered to the masculine, to the male sex. So it's just this bizarre, like, again, facade of, if I look it, therefore I am it. And the technology making me, like, the hubris of believing that could be true. And even the ease at which I could just live my life online. And it just further kind of gives you that promise of, I don't want to be in the real world. Now, puberty is an awful time period. So it also makes sense why women in particular, young girls, you know, feel burdened, want to escape the heaviness of what it means to be a woman. Most people will grow out of this. But if you're dangling the promise of escape, and maybe if I go this route, my problems will go away, and you've got millions and million dollar pharmaceutical industry interested in having patients for life, it's this awful congruence of things that have come together.
Would you say that all of this gender dysphoria stems from cultural Marxism and the assault on the family? Because you have a chapter in the book called Everything is Marxist, which I would pretty much agree with, because I always tell people that economic Marxism failed everywhere and was everywhere that has been applied or tried. But cultural Marxism has been extraordinarily successful down through the decades in terms of fundamentally transforming our culture, and especially the Marxist imperative to dissolve the family unit. Would you say that's part of it?
Oh, yeah. And people roll their eyes or think it's a boogeyman. But when you start to follow the seed back, that chapter is a bit tongue-in-cheek, calling it Everything is Marxist, but it really not, because once you open your eyes to the roots of the tree, how far back they go into, like, actually it is out of Marxist thought, this attempt to rewrite the family unit, abolish the family unit, enshrine abortion as the way to make sure we are identified by our work, strip male and female from one another, children belong to the state. It's like, hey, all of this came from Marx. And so, yes, like, Stephen Hicks wrote a fantastic book called Explaining Postmodernism. It's a bit heavy to start with unless you have had a philosophical background. But he helped me wrap my mind around, yes, economic Marxism has failed again and again, but it morphs into the other avenues of either, like, the sexual revolution has a lot of its foundational thought in Marxist thought, a lot of the climate activism. And again, we can be stewards of the environment. Like, as Catholics, it's I'm a believer of the both and. But also realize there's an agenda at work that is indeed, like, very much diminishing of humanity, as if we are the cancer on the planet. And has a much more interesting investment in control over people and their resources than it's pretty insidious once you start realizing what's going on behind the scenes. And again, it's not just this benevolent, let's take care of the planet. There's other factors at work. And so how Marxism has morphed, it's kind of like an octopus, into a lot of different avenues today that we can't really decode it on the surface. So a lot of the stuff is like, man, the stuff seems to have come out of left field, but it's all tied back to the same tree.
You write in the book that we can't put the postmodern genie back in the bottle. We can't retreat to the past. You say that we instead must go forward with, and I wasn't expecting this, but I think it's very insightful, we must go forward with humility and wonder. You say those are the antidotes. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, we can't go backwards. A lot of people, they look back at older times, like, oh, if we can only go back to, like, 1776, or it's like, listen, I don't think anyone really wants to go back there. Like, people like their air conditioning and the internet. Or in the Catholic circles, it's like, oh, if only we could go back before Vatican II, then everything would be right. But it's like, listen, we ended up here. So clearly everything wasn't okay then. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. So we're in the time we're in. So it's on us to make the best of what we have, and also realize we're not starting at zero. We're standing on the shoulders of great minds and thinkers who've come before us, but we've got to come up with new ways forward. So, and here too is where just the cynicism and the jadedness and the real nihilistic angst, the antidote is humility and wonder. Like, wonder, because this is where philosophy begins, is that question, why? Why are things the way they are? Why am I here? And little kids ask this all day long. We have 5 kids, 10 and under, and why is the question of the house. And I try not to shut it down, even if it's on echo. But it's like, yeah, don't stop asking why. And seek the answers to that. And I think in the age of the internet, where it's like, I don't need to know anything, I can just search for it. Like, why do I have to learn anything? Or if we've Google Earth the whole planet, it kind of strips the adventure, the mystery of discovery away from us, you know? But realizing, okay, but there's a lived adventure you're called into on the daily basis. There's the experience of encountering the people around you. Part of the problem is of the technology, it's so isolating. Ironically, how it connects us, it just keeps us in this bubble of ourselves. When we're made for community, we're made to be with other people, even people that disagree with us, even people that don't see the world as we see it. Like, here's where we're called to love and get out of our echo chambers and be with people where they are and have the humility of, like, and Jordan Peterson has talked about this, like, act like I have something to learn from this person. Even if they've espoused, from my vantage point, really wacky ideas, to at least recognize they're a human being. Maybe they know something I don't. Maybe I have something to learn from them. If not, even just the delight of being in their presence. Mother Teresa talked about the pandemic of loneliness. She visited from one of the poorest places in the world, Calcutta, India. She came to the United States in the 90s and said, the people here are more poor than the people where I serve. Because there is this poverty of meaning, and there's an epidemic of loneliness here in the United States. So it's not by bread alone. It's not by, again, that's kind of also the promise, the Marxist promise is like, oh, if we only have the right economic system, there'll be peace on earth. But, you know, there's always a lot of violence to get there, apparently. But we're not made for bread alone. We're meaning-seeking creatures. And to my students, I would gift them Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, which, again, to a 17, 18-year-old graduating Catholic school student, I'm giving them this book about a Jewish Holocaust survivor, kind of to wake them up and realize, listen, life is not going to be easy ahead, whatever is coming your way, but you can choose your attitude towards it. You can choose the attitude of dismissiveness and retreat, or you can approach the difficulties and the confusion and suffering with, I can choose my attitude towards this. I can choose how to make the best of this. I can choose to see that God has led me here and therefore wants me here in some capacity.
Another thing I wanted to ask you is about the importance of stories and storytelling as a way of reclaiming our humanity from postmodernism. Can you talk about that a bit?
Here's where I'd say, too, not everything that the postmodern thought has given us is bad. I think it's got because it's lost the sense of the subjective and what is true, all that's left is my truth. So what's left in postmodernity is a lot of storytelling and the subjective, which I think has value. I think we can have one foot in the subjective, and I want to hear your story. I want to hear what got you to this point in life. And then, can I ask you to listen to mine? Can I ask you to listen to why I have come to believe what I believe? Why I have come to arrive at a place of, I do think there's meaning. I think there's a truth outside of us. And Jesus himself used parables. He used stories. Like, we love stories. And there's a whole branch now of psychology, too, called narrative psychology, which is helping people make sense of their lives and their suffering by imagining yourself in a story and mapping that out. And you can see, like, here are my low points. Here is where I have suffered. But I can also see that I have agency. I am an agent in the story. And I can decide by my choices what comes next.
Let me ask you also about politics. We live in a time of deeper and more rancorous political division than I've seen in my lifetime, I think, and I've been around a while. How has postmodernism fed into that political division?
There's a chapter, it's titled Tribalism as Telos. And telos is the Greek word for purpose and meaning. And so what is the aim of my ship? Like, where am I pointed? Like, the telos of a chair is to be sat on. Like, that's its purpose. Like, and it fails at its purpose if I sit and it falls over or if it breaks. And so, too, like, what is the meaning? What is the telos of a person? And for we who believe that there is a God, it's to know, love, and serve him and serve the people around me. But without that, and everyone's just kind of every man for himself, everyone's making their own meaning, what's left? For some people, the big adventure, I want to fight in a good versus evil, and I've just been given this Marxist lens of oppressor versus oppressed. That's what's applied to everything nowadays. Well, for some people, that, again, is in climate activism. For some people, it's protesting on universities. for a lot of people, it's politics. Like, politics has become the religion. Instead of just, like, one thing in my life, it becomes the most important thing I'm rallying everything around, to the point of it's a religious fervor. And so it vilifies, it just seeks to vilify the other side, and we all get kind of sucked into it. And then, you know, families and friends have been spoiled over the politics of the day and holidays, and just being able to have a conversation with someone who, you know, it's to the point even where we can't even, and this is a whole nother tangent, but like, we're all reading different news. So it's like, in terms of interpreting reality in the same way, it's not that there's three news channels anymore. And you could argue that, well, the mass media did this to themselves in not being trustworthy and not being reporting, like, seeking what is true. Like, yeah, like, we could totally talk about that. But just even the fact that we can't agree on, like, the state of our country, or is it even good to be in Western civilization? There was some depressing stat I saw recently about, like, amongst Gen Z, I think it was barely over 20% would say they're proud to be American. And it's the same in the UK. So, and I mean, you think about what's the long-term consequences of that for a nation, for a civilization, it is pretty dire.
Definitely. I actually wrote an article about that recently. And along those same lines, postmodernism has allied itself with the internet, as you note in your book, to warp and fragment our perspective on reality. Is it possible for us to reverse engineer that in a way so that we can bring people together in positive ways that reinforce a healthy culture instead of driving us apart?
Sure. I think it's always easy to focus on the negative, but I also see a lot of signs of hope. More and more athletes I see proclaiming Christ or giving thanks to God, win or lose, but from the Olympics to the latest football championships. I'm seeing more and more young people just opt out of social media or go to dumb phones, wanting to invest in their health, and like, stuff that was the things of hippies and crunchy are now becoming more mainstream. Because I just think there's also an honest awareness of how unhealthy we are and how I shouldn't be on my phone to the extent I am. And so I think there is a healthy sense of wanting to step away from it and reclaim some sense of integration as a human person, which I think it bodes well. The technology is a gift, but we're not made the tool. Then we're not made to be sucked into it to the extent many of us are. So I do think, yeah, even the internet, as a Carlo Acutis is an Italian teen who's about to be declared a saint. He's the first millennial to be official saint of the Catholic Church, and that's coming up in April. And he talked about the internet being an atomic bomb. He says it can be an atomic bomb for good, it can be an atomic bomb for evil, as many of us know what's out there. But to use it to the best that we can, and then also know when to check out of it. And for we as parents to also lead the way, to not be glued to my phone all day in front of my kids, or to, you know, even among secular people, I know families that take a tech Sabbath, and they just one day a week, maybe a Saturday or Sunday, no phones, no nothing. We're just going to be play board games and be human persons again.
Bobby, with certain guests who are of a religious inclination, let's say, I like to ask this question because I think it's important to get insights into the kind of battle in which we are engaged in the West. And that question is, do you believe that we are, culturally speaking, engaged in spiritual warfare? And if so, and I suspect you do, how do you suggest people prepare themselves for that kind of fight?
Yeah, my answer is yes. And I think there is a healthy middle way to look at it, one in which doesn't just ignore it or, you know, tremble in fear every hour of the day. It's Christ has claimed us and given us the power to step out and walk in the gifts of the Spirit. And so we need not be afraid, but we also need to be smart and aware. It's not just philosophies and ideas, but powers and principalities that are, you know, kind of raging all around us. And that too is we're just kind of given this materialistic lens, and all that is real is just what we can physically touch and see. And when you realize there's more to it, it's humbling. And so, but we also have no reason to fear. So as a Catholic, to frequent the sacraments, to go to Mass more often than Sunday, if possible, because it's every day around the world, and to be where you are, because so many people, a lot of the work I've done in ministry, you have walked with many people that are just in paralyzing fear of the future, or they're beating themselves up endlessly about the past. And to realize, listen, like, God is the God of the present moment. And in the here and now, where your feet are on the ground, where the air is in your lungs, that's where he wants you, in this present moment. And Jesus himself says, have no anxiety about tomorrow, which is like, well, that's easy for you because you're God. So, but, you know, it's a commandment, like, don't worry. Stop worrying. Because there, too, I said earlier, I think, about, like, the kind of the fatherlessness of that we've inherited as a society. Like, from modern to postmodern time period, the rates of fatherlessness from earthly dads or dads who were just checked out. But then also just this kind of angst of, well, God doesn't exist. It's just kind of the belief in the water. If you want to believe it, nice, but deep down, many of us live our lives like practical atheists. Like, we only call on God if we need something. So there, too, is like, do I really trust that God has it? And if I don't, or if a part of me doesn't, then I am going to live every day with just kind of a simmering anxiety, because it's all on me. It's all on my shoulders. There's a Catholic psychologist, Dr. Bob Schutz, who talks about unholy self-reliance. Like, self-reliance is good. It's good to have discipline and get after it. But we can fall into this, well, it's all on me. It's all on my shoulders, which underneath that is, I don't trust God's going to come through. And I mean, why are people chronically anxious? Why are people depressed? For a whole host of reasons. But if you want to get to the bedrock of the postmodern situation we're in, there's a rebellion, which is a tale as old as time, against God, wanting to be ye as gods and remake reality. A fundamental distrust in, if God exists, he's just a tyrant, and we're better off rebelling. When in reality, what if he was a loving father that wanted to hold us and walk with us and support us and help us out of this quicksand to walk on steady ground again? We can't give what we don't have. So that's why I said earlier, like, we take care of ourselves first. And then you're able to have one foot on the shore of what is objective, what is true, good, and beautiful. And you can put the other foot in the subjective story of another person who is suffering, who may be drowning, and say, hey, I get it, I hear you. Come over here where there's something real to chew on and some real beauty to wonder at.
Very good. That's great advice. Bobby, where can people go on the internet to keep up with what you're doing, you and your wife?
We have a website, jackieandbobby.com, and it's got a lot of blogs and videos and more info about us. The book is The Postmodern Predicament, available at sophiainstitute.com or on Amazon. And then if you YouTube Jackie and Bobby, you're going to find a lot of our videos and work over the years.
Great. Bobby Angel, thanks again for joining us today, and keep up the important work.
Mark, thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Listeners, make sure you check out Bobby and his wife Jackie online and his brand new book, The Postmodern Predicament. If you are at all confused about how we got to where we are today and how to understand the madness of our time, that short book will lay it out for you. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so that you don't miss any of the important conversations we're having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave a positive review. See you next time. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.